Welcome. We're diving deep today into, well, a really big topic. It's sort of redefines humanity's place on Earth.
Yeah, we're asking a pretty sobering question, aren't we? Has our species, Homo sapiens, actually triggered the biggest biological crisis since, you know, the dinosaurs checked out?
Exactly. We're going to be unpacking Elizabeth Colbeard's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History.
It's such an essential read, and it really matters now because it pushes the conversation beyond just, say, rising temperatures.
Right.
It forces you listening, to recognize that our actions right now, well, they're basically making evolutionary decisions for millions of other species.
Decisions that, once they're made, you can't just undo them. They're irreversible.
They'll be irreversible.
Okay. Ooh, so let's get into this. Our mission today, really, is to understand not just that species disappeared, but how.
Mm-hmm.
What are the specific ways, maybe even the invisible ways, that we've set these changes in motion? We'll look at, well, everything from tiny fungi to huge chemical shifts in the oceans.
And what's really crucial to get right from the start is Colbert's argument that we are already living in what scientists call the Anthropocene.
The age of humans.
Yeah, the geological epoch defined by human dominance. She's not just speculating. She lays out this compelling, documented case that our impact, it actually rivals past catastrophes.
Like, you know, giant volcanoes or asteroid impacts.
Exactly, those kinds of things. Only this time, the force isn't external. It's, well, it's us.
Okay, so before we dive into the mechanisms and the evidence, maybe we should talk a bit about the author, Elizabeth Colbert. Who is she?
Yeah, good idea. So she's a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker. Her specialty is environmental reporting, and she's been covering these issues for decades. Really digs deep.
What makes her perspective so unique for tackling this huge, complex topic? I mean, she's not a biologist herself, right? Or the paleontologist.
No, she's not. And that's actually her strength here, I think. She isn't sort of locked into one specific scientific silo.
Okay.
She acts more like a scientific detective, mm-hmm, or maybe a translator.
I like that. A translator.
Yeah. Her real expertise is in this incredibly rigorous, immersive field reporting. She goes where the science is happening.
Right. She travels the world. Didn't she go to the Andes?
Yeah,
the Great Barrier Reef.
All over. The Amazon, Italy. Standing right there beside the scientists on the front lines, you know, seeing what they see.
So she's like the ultimate witness for us, the reader.
Precisely. And her gift is taking these really complex ideas, things like, you know, biogeographic theory or deep sea chemistry, and weaving them into this single understandable story.
Which is great because it stops it feeling like a textbook.
Exactly. It feels like an investigation. She keeps the tone very grounded, very factual. She's presenting the scientific consensus, letting the facts speak for themselves rather than, you know, preaching.
Okay, so Colbert travels the world, talks to scientists, gathers all this evidence. What's the central thread? What's the main argument tying it all together?
Well, her thesis is pretty stark. It's uncompromising, really. She argues that Earth is definitely undergoing its sixth mass extinction event.
The sixth one.
Mm-hmm.
And the previous five were caused by, what? Asteroids? Volcanoes?
Things like that, yeah. Massive natural events, external forces. But this one, Colbert says, is entirely anthropogenic.
Meaning? Caused by humans.
Caused by us. And crucially, she argues this isn't some, like, far-off future threat. It's happening now. The rates of species loss are already elevated. It's a present reality.
Okay, that's a huge claim. And, you know, being curious, you have to ask. Earth's climate, its biology, it's always changing, right? Things go extinct naturally.
Mm-hmm.
So how can she say so definitively that we are the unique cause this time, not just part of some natural cycle that plays out over millions of years?
That's a fundamental question, and the book really dives into it. She focuses on two main things, the speed and the scope of the changes.
Speed and scope, okay.
Past mass extinctions, you see, they generally unfolded over tens of thousands, sometimes millions of years. That gives life some chance, however small, to adapt or evolve.
Right, there's time to adjust.
But the change is happening now. We're talking decades, centuries at most. Our impact through climate change, chopping down forests, moving species around the globe, it's just happening way too fast for most life to keep up.
So it's like we didn't invent extinction, but we've somehow hit the fast forward button, crank the dial way up.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah. The book really becomes this investigation into the Anthropocene, into how one single species, us, could so fundamentally alter the trajectory of life on this planet. It's profound.
Okay, let's get into the specifics then. Colbert uses these really vivid case studies to show the mechanisms driving this.
Yeah, she does. It makes it very real. There are four primary mechanisms she identifies.
The scale feels overwhelming, but she actually starts with something quite small, right, to show how connected everything is. That Panamanian golden frog.
That's right, the Panamanian golden frog. Beautiful little creature, but now mostly gone in the wild. Critically endangered, possibly extinct in the wild.
And what's the cause there?
The villain in that story is a fungus. A mouthful to say. Batrachochytrium dendrobatitis. Scientists just call it BC.
Bee fungus, okay.
And the incredibly rapid worldwide spread of this amphibian disease is a direct result of human globalization.
How so?
Well, by moving goods and ourselves all over the planet, we've effectively reconnected ecosystems that were isolated for millions of years. Colbert calls it creating a new Pangaea.
Like the ancient supercontinent, but
yeah.
Artificial.
Exactly. And with that reconnection comes the spread of things like bread, pathogens that amphibians in one place might have resistance to, but others have never encountered. Biological chaos, really.
We usually think of invasive species as like big animals or plants taking over.
Right. But these microscopic hitchhikers can be even more devastating. So this beet fungus, what it does, it attacks the frog's skin.
Which is super important for frogs, isn't it? They kind of breathe through it.
In a way, yes. Their skin is incredibly permeable. They use it for hydration, for gas exchange, absorbing oxygen. The fungus disrupts the flow of electrolytes, essential salts, across the skin.
And that leads to?
Rapid cardiac arrest, heart failure. It's this silent killer spread globally because of our trade routes and travel. It's a stark example.
Wow. Okay, so that's one mechanism. Pathogen spread by globalization. What's next?
Let's shift to the oceans. Here, Colbert looks at how our CO2 emissions aren't just warming the planet, they're fundamentally changing the chemistry of the seawater.
Ah, ocean acidification. I've heard about this.
Exactly. The oceans act like a giant sponge, absorbing about a quarter of the CO2 we pump out. When CO2 dissolves in water, it forms carbonic acid.
Which, as the name suggests, makes the water more acidic, lowers the pH.
Yeah, precisely. And this change, while invisible to us day to day, is devastating for certain kinds of marine life.
Colbert connects this to past extinctions too, right?
She does. She reminds us this mechanism, acidification, likely played a big role in the KPG extinction, the one that wiped out the dinosaurs 66 million years ago. The asteroid impact was the trigger. But the massive release of sulfur and CO2 into the atmosphere likely caused intense, rapid ocean acidification, which helped finish off marine life like the ammonites. Those coiled shell creatures you see as fossils.
Okay, so history provides a warning. And today, who's most threatened by this acidification?
The main victims are organisms called calcifiers.
Calcifiers, like corals. Things that build shells.
Exactly. Corals, oysters, clams, mussels, certain types of plankton. Anything that needs to pull calcium carbonate out of the seawater to build its skeleton or shell.
Think of them as like the builders of the ocean structures.
Yeah, the architects, the masons. As the ocean pH drops, the building blocks they need, the carbonate ions become scarcer.
So it's harder for them to build their homes, essentially.
It's harder to build, and in some cases, the more acidic water can even start to dissolve existing shells and skeletons. It's like trying to build a house while someone's dissolving your bricks.
That sounds bad. Does Colbert show us what this looks like?
She gives us a terrifying glimpse into the future. She visits this place called Castello Aragonese. It's off the coast of Naples in Italy.
What's special about it?
There are natural volcanic vents on the seafloor there, releasing CO2 directly into the water, creating areas with lower pH, mimicking future ocean conditions.
A natural laboratory.
Exactly. And as you swim closer to those vents, you see this transition. The vibrant, complex coral reefs just disappear. They give way to these barren patches dominated only by tough, slimy algae. It's a stark preview of an acidified ocean. An uncontrolled global chemistry experiment.
Okay, so pathogens, ocean acidification, what's the third mechanism?
Moving back to land, she looks at habitat fragmentation. This isn't just about the total amount of habitat loss, like cutting down forests.
Right.
It's about how the remaining habitat gets chopped up into smaller, disconnected pieces.
Like breaking a dinner plate. You still have all the pieces, but it's not a plate anymore.
That's a great analogy, yeah. She visits the Amazon rainforest to look at this long-term study, the Biological Dynamics of Forest Fragments Project. Decades of research there.
And what did they find?
They found that these forest fragments, these islands of forest left behind after deforestation, they can't support the same level of biodiversity as a continuous forest.
Why not?
Several reasons. There are edge effects. The edges of the fragments are hotter, drier, windier, more exposed to predators and invasive species from the surrounding cleared land. And smaller fragments simply can't support species that need large territories or species that exist in low densities. Over time, species just start blinking out, disappearing from the smaller fragments in a somewhat predictable pattern. They run out of space, resources, mates.
So fragmentation creates these isolated islands on dry land.
Exactly. And it's not just horizontal fragmentation. Colbert also talks about islands in the sky.
Islands in the sky. What's that?
Think about mountains. As the climate warms, species adapted to cooler temperatures have to move upslope to stay in their comfort zone.
Makes sense. Go higher to stay cool.
Right. But mountains are cone-shaped, right? The higher you go, the less land area there is. So these species are retreating onto smaller and smaller islands of suitable habitat near the summit.
Until they run out of mountain.
Precisely. There's nowhere left to go. They get pushed off the top, effectively. It's another form of fragmentation driven by climate change.
Wow. Okay. Pathogens, acidification, fragmentation. Is there a fourth mechanism?
The fourth isn't so much a direct driver, but more a reflection on our response. Colbert looks at conservation efforts, specifically the desperate attempts to save the Sumatran rhinoceros.
One of the most endangered mammals on Earth.
Critically endangered, yeah. And she documents these heroic efforts involving high-tech veterinary science ultrasounds on rhinos, complex captive breeding programs, even frozen zoos preserving genetic material.
It shows incredible human ingenuity and, you know, compassion wanting to save these creatures.
Absolutely. But Colbert uses this case study to highlight the, well, the profound limitations of such approaches. Because even if we can keep a species like the Sumatran rhino alive in zoos or labs, what's the point if their natural habitat is gone? If the underlying driver is the deforestation, the climate change continue unchecked.
Right. It feels like treating the symptom, not the disease.
Exactly. It forces you, the reader, to confront this really difficult question. What are we actually saving? Is keeping a species alive in a lab truly conservation if the wild world that shaped it, the ecosystem it belonged to, no longer exists? It's a very sobering thought.
So if we pull back from these specific examples, the frogs, the corals, the rhinos, what are the big overarching messages Colbert wants us to take away? What's the bigger picture?
Yeah, connecting the dots, there are maybe four core messages that really define this Anthropocene situation she describes.
Okay, what's the first one?
The first is just the simple, stark recognition that humans are now a geological force. Our collective impact on the climate, on land use, on the planet's chemistry is now the dominant force shaping Earth's systems.
We're up there with volcanoes and asteroids now in terms of impact.
In terms of the scale and speed of change, yes. Which leads right into the second key theme, unprecedented speed.
We touched on this, but it's worth hammering home.
Absolutely. Because this is maybe the crucial difference. These current changes, the warming, the acidification, the habitat loss they're happening over decades, maybe centuries, that's warp speed in geological terms.
Compared to past extinctions that took thousands or millions of years.
Right. It's like comparing continental drift to a flash flood. There's simply no time for the vast majority of species to adapt through evolution. They can't keep up.
Okay, geological force, unprecedented speed. What's third?
The third is understanding this as a systemic collapse. It's not just about losing individual species, even really charismatic ones like tigers or pandas.
It's the whole web.
Exactly. It's the unraveling of intricate ecological webs that took millions of years to evolve. You lose the amphibians. Maybe you lose key predators of insects. You lose pollinators like bees.
You threaten our food supply.
Yeah, precisely. You lose coral reefs. You lose nurseries for maybe a quarter of all marine fish, impacting fisheries that feed millions. It's not just losing species, it's losing the functions those species perform, the stability they provide. It's a threat multiplier.
That makes sense.
And the fourth theme.
This one's a bit more speculative, maybe philosophical. Colbert explores what she calls the paradox of human nature.
Okay.
She touches on this idea. Is there something inherent in us, some kind of madness gene, as one scientist put it, a deep restlessness or compulsion to explore, to tinker, to change our environment?
The thing that drove us out of Africa, across continents.
Maybe. And that very restlessness, that drive, it's obviously the source of our incredible success as a species, our intelligence, our tool making, our ability to reshape the world.
It's also the engine of our destruction.
That's the paradox.
Yeah.
The same qualities that make us dominant might also be driving us to undermine the planetary systems we depend on. Our intelligence lets us see the problem, documented, even named past extinctions. But our inherent nature makes it hard to stop doing the things causing the current one.
It's a really provocative thought she leaves you with.
The book is definitely full of those kinds of challenging ideas, and some really memorable lines, too. Let's talk about a few key quotes or core ideas that really stick.
Yeah, there are some powerful ones. One that really captures our current agency, our unintended power, is this.
Okay.
She writes, "Right now, in the amazing moment that to us counts as the present, we are deciding, without quite meaning to, which evolutionary pathways will remain open and which will forever be closed."
Wow. Without quite meaning to. That hits hard.
It really does. It emphasizes that it's not necessarily conscious malice. It's the aggregate of our everyday decisions, how we power our homes, what we eat, how we travel.
All those little choices add up.
They add up to determine the future course of life on Earth. We're essentially closing doors in the library of life permanently, often without even realizing we're doing it.
That's a heavy responsibility. Okay, what's another one?
There's a fantastic analogy she uses to capture the, well, the sheer folly, the self-destructive irony of it all.
Let's hear it.
In pushing other species to extinction, humanity is busy sawing off the limb on which it is perched.
Oof. Yeah, that's blunt.
It's incredibly effective, isn't it? Because it makes it crystal clear. We depend on the biosphere. We need the stable climate, the clean air, the functioning ecosystems that we are actively dismantling.
It's not just about saving the pandas, it's about saving ourselves.
Yeah.
We're sitting on that branch too.
Exactly. It connects the environmental crisis directly to human self-interest, which is, you know, often a powerful motivator.
Okay, one more. Maybe something about the scale.
Yeah, to move it from the philosophical back to the hard number, she provides the stark list. It's just sobering.
What does she say?
It is estimated that 1/3 of all reef-building corals, 1/4 of all mammals, 1/5 of all reptiles, and 1/6 of all birds are headed toward oblivion.
Just reading that list. Hmm? Corals, mammals, reptiles, birds.
Yeah, it's a litany. It drives home that this isn't just a few isolated incidents. It's a systematic crisis affecting virtually every branch of the tree of life. It shifts the focus from sad anecdotes to the sheer magnitude of the problem.
Okay, this is, well, it's heavy stuff. It raises a really important question for anyone listening. How do you even begin to apply this knowledge? What do you do with it?
That's the crucial question, isn't it? And the book suggests the key application isn't just about, say, recycling more, though that's fine. It's more fundamental. It's about changing your awareness and your approach.
How so?
Well, first, it's about cultivating a deeper environmental consciousness, really internalizing those connections Colbert makes.
Seeing the links between, say, global trade and frog fungus.
Exactly. Or between your energy use and the chemistry of the ocean miles away. It means seeing that every policy debate about land use, every discussion about international trade, even your food choices, they're all connected to these global drivers of extinction, habitat fragmentation, carbon emissions, species transport.
It moves it from being abstract to being part of your daily context.
Right. It forces you to think systemically, not just locally.
Okay, what else?
Second, it really inspires, or should inspire, informed and urgent citizenship. Understanding the science of the Anthropocene gives you the tools, the vocabulary, the narrative to actually evaluate what's happening.
So you could look at a policy proposal maybe about carbon pricing or funding for national parks or regulations on shipping.
And you can assess it not just based on, say, local economic impact, but on its implications for planetary life support systems. It transforms these issues from political squabbles into matters of, well, planetary life and death.
Yeah.
It equips you to advocate more effectively.
That makes sense, giving you the why behind the advocacy.
Exactly. And finally, maybe most profoundly, it encourages a shift in worldview. It pushes towards humility and responsibility.
Really?
By decentering humanity a bit, moving away from seeing ourselves as the pinnacle, the sole purpose of creation or evolution.
And realizing we're just one part of this incredibly complex ancient web of life.
A very powerful part, yes. But still a part. A part that happens to be tearing the web apart. Recognizing that interconnectedness and our impact on it fosters a sense of responsibility for the whole, not just for ourselves.
Thinking back over the whole book, what's one thing that really stands out to you? Maybe something that surprised you?
For me, I think it's that paradox we mentioned earlier, the realization that the very same human intelligence, the cleverness that allows us to drill ice cores, analyze ancient DNA, reconstruct past climates, and document the 5 previous mass extinctions.
Yeah.
That same intelligence is what built the machines, the systems, the global economy that's driving the sixth one. It's a deeply tragic irony, isn't it?
It really is.
Yeah.
The tool for understanding is also the tool for destruction. What surprised me most, actually, was the historical context you mentioned earlier.
About extinction itself being a new idea.
Yeah. It's kind of mind-boggling that the whole concept of species permanently disappearing, that wasn't really accepted scientifically until, what, the early 1800s?
That's right. Thanks largely to Georges Cuvier, the French naturalist, analyzing fossils like mammoths and realizing they were creatures that simply didn't exist anymore.
Before that, people just assumed that God wouldn't let a whole species vanish. Or maybe they were just hiding somewhere.
Pretty much. The idea of irreversible loss was radical. It just underscores how recently we've even gained this understanding of life's fragility on geological timescales.
And yet, look how quickly we've become the primary driver of that fragility since then. It's, sobering.
So wrapping this all up, what's the final thought for you, the listener, to take away from Colbert's work?
I think it boils down to this. Colbert makes it clear we are the first species ever to be aware in real time that we are causing a mass extinction event. We can document it. We understand the mechanism.
We have the knowledge.
We have the knowledge. So the ultimate provocative question the book leaves us with is, what does it say about us, about our collective wisdom, perhaps our collective priorities, that this unprecedented awareness hasn't yet translated into the collective capacity to actually change course, to stop sawing off that limb we're sitting on? See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world.
This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.